Hello, this is Gail Sotto for Think Magazine, talking today with Nancy Lublin, CEO and Chief Old Person, a title I challenge, by the way, at Do Something, Inc., an organization that acts as a connection point and clearinghouse for young people who want to do good work. She's also the founder of Dress for Success, a nonprofit that helps women transition successfully into the workforce. Nancy, this is a very long introduction, but thank you for chatting with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're so excited to hear from you at Think 11 this coming May. I guess I'd want to start by asking you about your first venture, Dress for Success. I read that you started with $5,000 in startup money, which is pretty incredible. I think some people would say that this wasn't really a realistic plan, and yet somehow you made it work. How did you get the organization off the ground, and do you think that you were able to do it because you had some sort of supernatural abilities, or do you think...
I wish. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Supernatural abilities would be awesome. If I could be invisible or fly, that would be so awesome. So great. No more airport security. Oh, my gosh. Flying would be great. I don't even know if I can call it startup money. I was a miserable law student, and I came home one day, a miserable February cold, rainy day, and in the mailbox was an envelope from a lawyer. Inside was a check made out of me for $5,000 from the estate of my great-grandfather, who had died a number of years earlier, so I had already mourned his death. But it was so strange to get a windfall from the set if he was this amazing, like, Horatio Alger, American Dream type person who came to this country with nothing. And I thought, I didn't earn this money. It's not mine. And as I got into the elevator with the check in my hands, I had the idea for Dress for Success. And, yes, totally unrealistic, crazy, you know, 23-year-old young person with a dream. And so I didn't sit down and write a business plan. I didn't call, you know, rich parents of friends of mine. I just got to work right away and started making it happen, which is the best piece of advice I can give to anybody with a dream, which is stop talking about it and start doing it.
That's so great. I mean, now looking back on that, if somebody came to you and said, I've got $5,000, I think I'm going to start my own nonprofit organization, would you be able to say, oh, yeah, that's going to be great? Or, I mean,
no,
from where you are now, what does that sound like? Oh, my goodness. Don't.
Or I'd pay off credit card debt, or I'd buy shoes and then pay off the credit card debt. I don't know. I mean, no, I mean, it's significant that I was miserable and in law school. I mean, I think, you know, good things grow in the dirt. And I do think that when you're in an awful situation like that, it's you will work hard to get out of it when your back's against the wall. And so I don't think it's like, hey, I want to be famous, or hey, I want to start my own business. I get so many people coming to me saying, I want to run my own not-for-profit. And I say, okay, what are you passionate about? Well, I'm not sure yet, but I know I want to run my own not-for-profit. They are doomed. They are totally doomed. And I don't really help those people very much.
Right.
I tell them they're doomed and to go do something else. Maybe that is a form of helping. I don't know.
Because the one thing that you did start with, in addition to your $5,000, was a really great idea. And maybe for people who don't know Dress for Success, we should say a couple words about what it is Dress for Success does.
Yeah, you know, to Dress for Success, help women transition from welfare to work. It's really due to self-sufficiency. So women who are in domestic violence programs or homeless shelters or, you know, work assistance programs, they come and they get a suit for a job interview. And then when they get a job, they get up to a week's worth of clothing. And then Dress for Success is one of the only organizations that help women keep their jobs after that through this professional women's group program. It's a great organization. The idea really came from... as a kid, you know, my father once told me that when he was hiring secretaries, he was a lawyer in Hartford, Connecticut, he would look out the window and watch women go from their car to the building, in the parking lot, and he'd know before they reached the building whether or not he would hire them.
Really?
I said, what? How can you say that? That's awful. And he said, you know what? The fact of the matter is, in this world, appearance matters a lot. It can tell you a lot about a person. Now go comb your hair. And horrified by that. But, I mean, it's true. We all wear uniforms, right? Whether you're on the field or off the field, the shirt you wear on a Saturday night is probably 2 inches shorter and 2 sizes smaller than the shirt that you would wear on a Monday morning. And, you know, you have your lucky suit or your lucky shirt. Or, you know, you buy a new outfit for a friend's wedding or special occasions. I mean, we have these sort of uniforms. But if you don't have any money, or it's not even just the money, you don't have someone in your family who's ever worked in an office, or you've never known anybody who's worked anywhere other than the McDonald's or 7-Eleven, you really don't know how to dress for a job interview. So here in New York, when I started the organization, and I started it, oddly enough, with some nuns from Spanish Harlem, that's inventory, when we all sat around talking about the need for this program, you know, they were giving me stories like that one of them sent a woman for a job interview the week before, and she showed up in a Sergio Tacchini tracksuit. Why? It was the most expensive thing she owned. Or that there were women who were making appointments for job interviews and not showing up because they really didn't know what to wear and they were just embarrassed.
Yeah, it's, I think the other thing that's so, such a, makes it such a great idea is that's one piece of a person's transition that you can really affect immediately. If someone doesn't have job skills, or, you know, there are all these other pieces to the puzzle that have to be there, but helping them with their wardrobe is something that you can fix, right? You can give them a lot of help with just a small gesture. It's great. And it is a key piece to the puzzle.
They're reading this. You know, like, the person who can do the fixing, it's a very woman-to-woman solution. You know, mm-hmm. Like, you can clean out your closet right now, pull out two suits that maybe they don't fit you anymore, or you don't want to wear them anymore, or you don't need them anymore. And you're going to know that they're going to two other women going for job interviews for jobs that could change their whole lives. Like, it's a very direct form of volunteerism and philanthropy that's like being in your sister's closet, right?
Yes.
Trying something on or getting something from her. It's very personal.
Well, it's just a great... It's a great story and a great organization. And so from there, I saw that you've written a book, Zilch, that is suggesting that for-profit companies can learn by emulating some of the things that nonprofits do. In what ways do you think for-profits can be successful by being a little more like nonprofits?
Because we know how to stretch a dollar. We know how to stretch people. We know how to get 90 minutes out of an hour.
Uh-huh.
I think not-for-profit, that's like our everyday modus operandi, right? We never have enough. So I kind of laugh when my for-profit friends say, oh, my marketing budget was slashed to $4 million. I mean, I just giggle. $1 just in marketing money. Oh, my gosh. It'd be great. I wouldn't just go buy a bunch of balloons, you know? So,
exactly.
You know, it was motivated by that. It was really, it's sort of two parts. One is for all those for-profit people to learn our best practices and think differently. But the other people that Zilch is really written for is those people in the not-for-profit state, those volunteers, those employees, to give us some pride. It's sort of a manifesto that says, actually, we know what we're doing, and there's some really great best practices here that should be shared and emulated.
I think for sure. I think another component to it as well is that, having worked in nonprofits a couple of times in my life, there's a lot of passion and dedication, I think, that's very – and people at nonprofits are not getting rich by any stretch of the imagination, and yet they bring so much dedication and work ethic with them.
I think sometimes that notion is overdone to the sense that, like, people think that people who work at not-for-profit are martyrs, or that we all have, you know, fuzzy legs and Birkenstocks on, right?
Yes.
And that, you know, I don't know, that, like this sort of typical, and, like, I eat granola and I'm, like, a vegan or something. I just want to say I really like cheeseburgers, and I don't own any Birkenstocks. Unless they start making them in, like, a 4-inch stiletto, I'm probably not going to rock any Birkenstocks anytime soon. I mean, part of the reason for writing the book was to break down some of the stereotypes of people who work in not-for-profits. They're not just, you know, passionate people who lead with their hearts. They're also really smart. And there's some really creative work practices going on at not-for-profits. Like, they're MacGyvering solutions in really smart ways.
Yes. Well, it sounds like that's exactly what's happened since you've joined Do Something. That it's been a question of making your mission successful, but also it sounds like you've turned things around operationally in a way that you can really leverage what resources you have to make the most impact out in the community.
Yeah, this is the turnaround when I got there. I mean, when I got there, the place was really broken. They had just laid off 21 out of 22 people. There was $75,000 left in the bank, but they had spent another $250 from foundations and yet not complied with any of the grant restrictions. So really, we were in the hole. And they had lost their office space, and everything was in boxes and storage in Queens, and nobody knew who had heat. So it sort of doesn't get any uglier than that. And I took the job because I saw there was no cool, fun youth organization doing social change in this country. And I thought the name Do Something Essential and some of the people involved with the organization, it's kind of like a pike fan. Like, they feel like they shed their leaves all the time. But as long as the roots are still good, you know it'll come back to life again. Just like that with good roots. And I was the bad cop in Toucan Town, the new sheriff, guns ablaze, when I first got Do Something. And I was chipping it away at things and really getting it to be focused on a singular purpose and a singular target market. Sometimes when organizations lose their way, they follow the money, something called mission creep. They said that they were targeting young people, which they define as age 5 to 30, which is a family. I mean, that's not young people, plus teachers and parents. And I said, no. So it took me a few years to whittle it down to just teenagers, for example. But to have to be much more focused and intentional in our work, to say no to various partnerships, and all of it that is in that book. But, it's been a turnaround, and we're in great shape now. We're one of the largest organizations for teenagers and social change in America.
It's so great and so necessary. I think the teen years are a time when kids really do want to make a difference, and they have the energy to do it. And yet it can be very difficult to figure out how to plug in. And very frustrating.
Requirements. We never require money. We never require an adult, and we never require a car. And we found that those are those three barriers that make it so difficult. Because not every kid has access to money or a car. And once you require an adult, you basically told the teenager, I don't believe in you.
Right. That's exactly right. I think what you've been really successful at is getting down to the level of the people who are actually going to participate and understanding their world so that you can provide them what they need. Which I think sometimes when you are the chief old person, when you're not a teenager anymore, you forget.
I'm not, but the kids, my office is mostly 20-somethings, and I'm just a lot more tired than they are.
Yes.
And, I listen to different music than they do, and I think that's successful. And I think that the most important thing for any company is really getting to know and love your target market. If you can't sell handbags and actually not like women. You can't be a hairdresser and not love hair. And you can't work with teenagers and like not really love teenagers. So, I have a Hello Kitty bicycle that I ride to work a lot. Everything stops for me on a Tuesday night so I can watch Wii. I live the brand. And when I was doing Dress for Success, I was really living that brand and being in the sort of women's work space. And I think that's really important for any business and business owner and employee. But I really love what it is that you make or sell or who you're targeting.
That's so true. I guess the last thing I would ask you about is how some of these ideas may connect for credit union. They kind of straddle both worlds. They're technically not-for-profit ventures, but they compete against for-profit banks. So they're kind of trying to occupy two different ecological niches in a way. From your perspective, do you think that sounds like an uncomfortable position to be in, or do you think sometimes
law made of companies with double bottom lines lately? The idea of social entrepreneurs, of people who are doing good while doing well. And I really think you have a pick. And I'm a not-for-profit person who really believes that the sector has good things to offer, but that, like, at the end of the day, if you're a for-profit business, if there are certain decisions and you have to cut a corner to show a profit, you have to. You've got to answer to shareholders. You've got to, you have a responsibility to certain people. Whereas if you're a not-for-profit, I mean, I'll be honest, for years, my money was in a credit union because that's where my values were. And I knew that, at the end of the day, they really cared about my community. So I think that you always take, there's no such thing as a double bottom line. You're always having to pick one thing over the other.
Right.
I don't know if that's really answering the question you were asking, but that's my opinion.
No, but I think what you say is absolutely true. And maybe part of the challenge for credit unions is if they're really going to be not-for-profit and they really are wearing the white hats, they need to get that message out.
And you don't want to be just like Chase, do you? That's
no.
The reason why you're a credit union instead, right?
Right, exactly. And so maybe that's part of the lesson to be learned. It's okay to be a nonprofit. there's a lot of value to it.
And that's, again, part of my book, and that's, like, the pride in it, right? It is okay to be a not-for-profit. And, by the way, I never say nonprofit, because to me, nonprofit is, like, most of Detroit, most airlines, and several dot-coms.
Yeah, there you go.
I work at a not-for-profit, and there are lots of nonprofits out there, and I never aspire to be one of them.
That's a very good distinction to point out. So, I mean, I've certainly enjoyed chatting with you today. We're definitely looking forward to hearing more from you at Think 11 this May. And again, thanks for taking some time to chat with us today. I look forward to seeing you at Think.
Thank you. Me too. We had a terrific taxi ride together through New York City.
That's right. I feel like I was there.
You were. You just rode from one neighborhood to the next with me. So thank you.
Oh, lovely. Okay,
I'll
well, have
you.
A lovely day.
Great. You too.
Okay, thanks.